If it's talk, tunes, tales and talent you're after, you've come to the right place. Radio Energy.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Vonnie and Joe Show. I'm Vonnie.
And I'm Joe.
And we're here today. We're joined with Rachel Younger, who's here to talk to us about neuroscience in journalism.
Hello.
Hello to you too. Sorry, that was very rude of me. And we're joined by some guests. We have Bronwyn and Elaine.
Hello.
And we're going to talk a little bit about neuroscience and journalism. Those two things are not things that you would naturally put together. Why is it relevant to journalists today to think about neuroscience?
Let's talk first of all about the fact that neuroscience is basically a posh word for the science about the brain. As journalists, we use our brain to, you know, ask questions and tell stories. So we know that we use our brain. The reason we've called this neuroscience, though, is that actually sometimes as journalists, we encounter people in traumatic situations and we tell their story. We witness traumatic things, either by watching them on the internet or walking up to them. So if you've got, for example, a terror attack at the Manchester Arena, you're going to walk towards it whilst others are walking away from it. And sometimes, actually, we are affected by it ourselves. So we have interviewees who are affected by it, and we are. And something happens to our brain when that mm-hmm. takes place, and mm-hmm. the trauma can actually change who we are as a person. And that's why I talk about neuroscience for journalists.
Rachel, thank you. Perhaps we could go to another guest we have in the studio, Bronwyn, who's been a journalist for many years, a TV journalist. Bronwyn, I know you have some experience of working in these kind of potentially traumatic environments. Would you be able to share some of the experiences you've had as a journalist?
Yes, with pleasure. First of all, I think that the first thing is that our emotions obviously go straight through the prefrontal cortex to be sort of processed elsewhere in the reptilian brain. And I think this is part of the problem that can result when we're exposed to situations that can, as you say, be emotional. For me, I've never worked in a war zone, although I've had some experience in post-war zones or with people recovering from people in socioeconomic problems or that sort of thing. And what I find difficult is, in order to do the kind of reports that I generally do, which is quite long format video, and it's not impartial journalism just covering facts, it's really getting to the story and helping people to tell their stories, which is what is most important to me. Mm-hmm. In order to do this, we need to really invest in the relationships. The point is not to show these people that are in difficult situations as zoo animals. For example, mm-hmm. in the Syrian refugee camp mm-hmm. Al-Zaatari on the Jordan border where I was shooting a while ago, they were so used to journalists coming in and just observing them, arriving, setting up the camera, taking shots, and off they would go. And this was observation, and also being that the journalists represented the Western world, who weren't doing anything in their view to help the situation, it becomes conflictual. So trust needs to be developed. And by doing that, what we need to do simply is go and see people, go and sit in their tents, sit on the floor with them and share their food, play with the children, talk to the children, do all these things, which come so naturally. And it's something that I want to do, and it's the part that I enjoy the most out of mm-hmm. this work. Mm-hmm. But then the problem is when you leave, and you think of these people with whom you've formed relationships, because I'm also very lucky I work with Swiss Media. We still have the opportunity to go. We had 2 weeks preparation just to meet people, 10 days. Meet people, get to know them, get to know the lay of the land and everything. So when we left, these relationships that we had formed, especially with children, really got to me. I didn't want to go back to our sort of Western civilization where everything seemed so unimportant and so banal and so trivial. I felt guilty. Mm-hmm. There was a very, very intense sense of guilt that I was lucky enough to have my beautiful clean bed and my shower and be able to wash every day. Mm-hmm. The dignity of the people mm-hmm. that have lost everything, including the family hierarchy, because the men have been completely mm-hmm. emasculated, because the woman has lost her place in the home as a homemaker because the children are not in school and they are traumatized and sometimes physically as well from the war.
Bronwyn, do you think that there's perhaps an argument here that maybe we're getting a bit soft? Haven't journalists always had to do this? Haven't they always had to go into traumatic situations? Why do you think that we have to pay attention to things like mental health now? Is it any worse than it was?
I think that that's a two-sided thing to that. From the kind of experiences that I'm talking about, where it's an emotional attachment that brings about the difficulties and the trauma lived perhaps vicariously through those people that you're engaging with every day. That's one thing. It's a different kind of thing. As far as getting soft on journalists, journalists becoming softer, no, I would not agree. I think that as much as the Me Too movement, the all sorts of other movements, the PTSD, we talk so much more about it in the war sense with soldiers who are suffering from that. I think it's the same sort of awareness that is coming through with the difficulties that journalists face.
Mm. So PTSD, that's serious. That's trauma. Rachel, is trauma the accurate word? Is that the right word for what journalists are experiencing?
Let me talk about stress there. So I think I'd like to come to trauma, but let me talk about stress. And I want you, obviously this is a radio medium, so you can't see my hand, but I'm going to hold up my hand and I'm going to curl it up to a fist. And if you think about the fist as your brain, if you've got the fingers that are curled over the thumb, that would be your prefrontal cortex. So it would be the intellectual part of your brain, the reasoning part of your brain. And that would be digesting information in an intellectual way, which we journalists like to pretend that we do. We like to pretend that we're very reasonable people who can be impartial and detached from stories and report them in an intellectual way. And that has been our tradition as journalists, at least in the Western media that I've worked in. I don't think it's been the case all over the world. And then if you actually lift your fingers up, you've got right underneath there, you've got that thumb tucked into the fist. And that thumb would be a picture for your limbic system. Now, or you could also say your amygdala. Now, that is an interior part of the brain with different bits to it that is actually the emotional part of the brain. Now, what you need to know is that the emotional part of the brain, is actually very flexible. So let's say that we've got a lion that comes up to you and it kind of like frightens you. In the first instance, you don't know, is the lion going to eat you or is it just saying hello in a roary kind of way? But essentially, you get what we call an amygdala hijack, which is basically you are totally on alert. So from the closed fist that I was first showing you to the fingers flipped up with, now we're seeing the thumb, right? That amygdala hijack, in that case, the thinking part of the brain gets switched off because it's not quick enough to deal with things. The thinking part of the brain is like the long-term memory style type of the brain. Mm-hmm. It processes things slowly overnight and roots things deeply. But when you see a lion and you need to react quickly, it's your emotional part of the brain that will sometimes react quicker than you can think. So your reaction is fight, flight, or freeze. Exactly. Thank you. So essentially, you're going to do one of those, and that will come from your subconscious. So it'll be quicker than your rational thinking. Mm-hmm. Now, for you to be able to react quickly to this lion, what you're going to do is you're when you have an amygdala hijack, which is a state of emergency, your whole body is going to shut down non-essential functions. So digestion is not really an issue right now. You can digest later, right? Mm-hmm. So your stomach will stop digesting for a while, but your blood needs to transport, you know, oxygen to the brain so you can think quickly. So you'll have a raised blood pressure, and so there's all sorts of things. They call it the HPA axis, so the hypothalamus and the adrenal glands as well. They will react. So you'll have a rush of adrenaline, a rush of cortisol, and cortisol and adrenaline are good in a quick situation. So let's say that I'm responding to the Manchester Arena attack that unfortunately happened recently. The first thing you're thinking is pictures, run toward the best pictures, get the quotes. So you're switching off anything that is stopping you from doing your job, or, you know, in the case of the lion, you're obviously legging it. Hopefully you're not freezing because that'll make you lion food. But so essentially that's a really good function because it keeps you safe to be able to react quickly. Now, the problem is that with us journalists, because we've got constantly raised cortisol levels all the time, it never stops. And then we tend to kind of like, the way that I used to be a journalist was that I used to eat a Twix and drink a Red Bull, and that was my food for the day. And I'd have maybe 3 to 4 hours sleep, and the rest I was on wire working. And if I wasn't working, I was on, it wasn't social media in those days, but I was following the whatever news I could get hold of before the days of social media. So basically, you're always, your cortisol levels are constantly raised.
And that's the stress hormone, is that?
That's
right.
Cortisol is a stress hormone. Thanks for, yeah, I'm speaking technology here. So when your cortisol levels are constantly raised, you're not really digesting, are you? And you're not really breathing deeply, and you're not really relaxing. So the human being has been made for stress and then relax, and then stress and relax. That's the sympathetic and the parasympathetic going back and forth between each other. Mm-hmm. And that is healthy. But as a journalist, so before we get to the traumatic situation like the Manchester Arena, you have spent the last few years close to burnout because you've been running, never stopping, always on the go. You know, ask my husband, he's not used to this lifestyle, and he's like, you're still at it. You know, sometimes in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock, he'll wake up and say, your brain is thinking so loud, I can't sleep. I'm not speaking, I'm just thinking. So that's kind of like the word journalist. Mm-hmm. So,
Rachel, can I ask you, just gave the example of the Manchester Arena attacks and
yes.
the instinct to run towards
yes.
all the action is. I think for many, many people, their instinct would be to run away from that.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think it is in a journalist that gives them that instinct? Do you think it's natural? Do you think it's something they're trained into doing? Do you think it's normal?
I don't know. I mean, I was born with this instinct that I had to be there when the news was happening. So for me, if a story is happening, I have to be there. I have to grab my camera. I have to tell the story. I have to witness it. I have to know. I don't know if every journalist is the same. I do think that the industry is like that. So the thing is that in the industry, for me, it's genetically programmed, and it's very difficult for me not to run towards danger when I mm-hmm. see it. So mm-hmm. had I been in New York on 9/11, I would have probably been at the top of the tower when it came down. That was my genes. I think that maybe the industry has been very macho. I'm not going to say it's because there was more men than women in the industry, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. maybe true, but maybe not. But the industry has very much had this thing, let's laugh it off. Mm-hmm. So when I was working in the Iraq war, yes, you would be humanly affected by things, but I had a lot of situations where in the evenings we had curfew, so we couldn't go out. So we'd be sitting around a table drinking alcohol. Maybe it was a pub, maybe it was somewhere. And everybody was telling when I was in Rwanda, it wasn't, all the genocide. And East Timor, do you remember and you're
so
bigging it up. It's kind of like, it's
mm-hmm.
a culture of pretending that it doesn't affect you. Mm-hmm. And so people around me were 3-4 times divorced and were on alcohol and drugs. And this was normal. Like the whole environment, everybody mm-hmm. around me was damaged. And it was normal to be damaged. And it was normal to just laugh it off.
Mm.
And is that genetically programmed? I think part of it is actually the socialization. You join the newsroom, and if you're a bit too flimsy, you might not be the person that they send for the story. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So you want to make sure that everybody knows you're robust. And and part of it is also, I just loved the adrenaline. I used to live on adrenaline. I didn't need to eat in the old days.
So it sounds like poor coping mechanisms are kind of endemic to the industry. So I guess that doesn't matter what kind of stress, what kind of trauma you face, whether you are in a war zone or whether it's something that you're coming out of.
Mm-hmm.
Bronwyn, what kind of coping mechanisms did you find that worked for you? Were they healthy? Were they unhealthy? Do you even have a solution?
Not really. meditation, I guess, and... I've done some therapy, but the thing is when you're working, you might have a project straight afterwards. You don't have the time, and I think this is probably what you want to encourage us to do, is to take a step back, take stock, and take care of our mental health and our physical health and everything else, even our relationships that it may have been neglected during that period.
Mm-hmm.
But I do find it's difficult because not only, as I say, a project can follow another in quick succession, but also, in my case, I'm quite often responsible for my video team, so 2 or 3 other people. And that's, I find, an added stress that also happens in between the times when you're actually in a country doing a report on something in maybe a more difficult country. because you need to organize their safety. I think if you're working on your own, you're responsible for your safety and you're like, okay, I'll take precautions and I'll do this as I should. But when you've got the responsibility of other people in your team, that just is exponential. The permissions and the people that I speak to in the government or the police, the forms I have to fill in, getting a fixer, and that will help us when we're in the country, but also somebody that can, in the Syrian refugee camp, to use that example again, there was a, while we were there, there was a subject by Al Arabiya that came out that spoke about the young girls in the refugee camp who had been married off to older, much older Jordanian men, quite rich. So this is extremely controversial because we know, we understand why it was done, but of course it's a tragedy. They would be married for a few months and raped, and and that was it. So this was exposed during the period that we were in the camp. So from one day to the next, the tension escalated, and that's when we were threatened with stones and knives, and we had people around us and a big mob and showing us the program, etc. And so after that, I actually hired somebody, a Syrian, that that was highly recommended, that was living in the camp, to negotiate with people, with other Syrians in the camp, to tell them who we were, where we were from. Luckily, when you're from Switzerland, that's quite often a good entrance instead of maybe France or England or the States. And that was helpful. So that's not really that's maybe a coping mechanism, to come back to your question, about how to protect the team, which is protecting myself. But that's not coming back and helping.
It sounds like you just don't have any time to switch off.
That's often the case. And it's, I think, even worse for the camera crews with whom we work, because I, between projects, I'm still preparing and I'm editing and everything else, whereas they go from one project to the other without ever having time to de-stress, and with very little support actually from the from the companies or the TV stations that hire them.
And Rachel, have you found in your research that that's fairly standard throughout the industry, this lack of support? The fast pace, and also the lack of support.
I mean, I wouldn't go with quantitative statistics, but absolutely, the situation you're describing, Bronwyn, is exactly what people experience. And I think the problem is, you just said it, when people come home, or even, you know, on the end of the day, you're going to your tent or you're, you know, wherever you're sleeping, you know. So I would say one of the biggest problems with the way journalists are handling these stories is something happens, you interview people, you need to file copy. And you need to, you're trying to stay impartial and detached so you can get your copy out there, and you can do it in a professional way, not crying. So essentially what happens is you forget the bit that other people might do, which is the debrief and which is the digestion. So let's say you have got a situation like you described, a traumatic situation, which is stressful. So let's say that you never know what's going to traumatize you. In my case, the one thing that did actually have a physical impact on me was that I actually filmed, there was a lorry, a car with a family, and a lorry, and the back lorry, the guy that was driving it was eating his breakfast, didn't brake when there was a traffic jam, and the car was squeezed between two lorries to the length of 1 meter. And, you know, for me, it was the whole stress of finding, you know, when there's an accident on the motorway, how do you get on there to get the film footage before the police stop you? So the whole stress of getting there and on there. So I was filming these close-ups and I was making sure it was in focus, getting the footage back to the newsroom. And it's only much later that I realised I couldn't overtake lorries anymore on the motorway for years. So that was basically because I hadn't digested that news story that I witnessed. That became part of a physical reaction that I had, which was, people would say, why can't you overtake lorries on the motorway? I actually was reacting in a physical way to the trauma, because I'd, and what I'd like to explain is, and this is exactly what you've also said, if you don't debrief, Bronwyn. So what happens is you've got your amygdala hijacked. So you've got your fingers, which are the neocortex, which flip up like the lid is flipped, right? So what that does is your emotions are exposed and they're responding quickly, but you're basically, your thinking brain is switched off. It has to be that way so you can react quickly, right? But if you don't get together with colleagues or with somebody kind and you debrief and talk to them about your emotions and how you experience this within the next maybe 48 hours, and you sit down and you digest it, what then happens is that the trauma memory can actually get buried rather than in a rational way in because you've managed to talk about it and make sense of it, even though making sense never, you know, you can't make sense, but you can try to make sense and express your emotions. If you don't do that, what happens, it gets buried. Think about the very bottom of your hand where it's nearly going into your arm. And think of that as basically the reptilian brain. So basically we've got a part of our brain which is it's basically the stem, the brain stem. That are the things that we do as a baby. So as a baby we cry for food when we're hungry, and we sleep, and we learn how to walk. So the subconscious things, so have you ever driven a car home and basically you thought, how did I get here?
Because
it was subconscious, so that's stored in your basically subconscious brain. And we store trauma memories there if we don't digest them consciously. And what happens is if they're stored there, they will start triggering us. Some people start drinking alcohol, and they don't know why they can't control it, but basically it's because they've got memory that they can't access with their verbal memory. So when trauma is stored in this subconscious part of your brain, it's actually controlling with you without you being able to verbalize it, maybe. So for example, I have these irrational reactions where I couldn't overtake lorries. I couldn't force myself, even though my rational brain was telling me there's enough space, I can. My eyes were telling me, you know, there's the few centimeters left and right of the car to get past the lorry. But my subconscious was steering me. I couldn't get over this. Now, the best thing for journalists to be would get rid of the macho culture and sit together round the campfire like they did in the old days before the days of telly and mobile phone, and actually talk to each other about it. And I want to talk about soothing when you're a baby.
Like swaddling?
Let's say that you've got a mum, and the mum's holding the baby in her arms, and the baby's crying. And have you ever seen mirroring? So the mum, the baby goes, rah, and the mum goes, rah, and then the baby points, and the mum points, and the baby goes, rah, the mum goes, rah. This is mirroring. The baby feels safe because in a safe environment with somebody that's holding and feeding and, you know, making the baby feel safe, it's getting the mirroring from, you know, I hear you, I see you. This interaction. Now, it sounds stupid, but actually, if we want to deal with trauma, that is exactly what needs to happen. We need to sit with somebody that we trust, that we feel safe with. And sometimes this should be institutionalized in newsrooms, that if you've had a team of reporters out reporting, you know, something like the children in the refugee camp or the Manchester Arena, or in my case, the accident, but I was alone as a VJ a lot. You have to be able to sit and actually talk about how you feel. Because if somebody sitting opposite you hears you, what's happening is that safe, soothing feeling that you get when your mum holds you when you're a baby. And when you go, rah, your mum goes, rah. And actually the mum's saying, I hear you. And that makes you feel safe. And what then happens is you're actually storing that memory in the rational brain, where you can then start dealing with it later. And it's not the trauma brain, which is the subconscious brain, where it's triggering you and you don't know how and why. And this is something that journalists don't seem to understand, that actually they're building up these experiences that are going into that subconscious brain that is actually supposed to be for learning how to ride a bike and learning how to go to the loo and, you know, and learning how to digest. But instead, it's actually being used for something totally
wrong. Damaging experiences.
And so then, of course, if that has happened, that you've built up a lot of that, what can actually happen, and that's why I'm talking about neuroscience, is that you can start the stress, the overload of cortisol can actually start eating away at your brain physically.
Oh, goodness.
Demyelination of the brain, the nerves, it means the fatty substance that protects the brain, can start. So you can have physical damage if you don't take the debriefing and the safe environment and the talking to people and telling people you've heard them. If you don't take that seriously, it'll have consequences. Okay. As a journalist,
so what does that look like for a journalist? So say, for example, I've been somewhere and I've seen something really awful. You know, my brain's not working in the way that it should. What does the debrief look like? What's the first thing that I should do? Could you walk me through that process?
So if we compare Bronwyn in the refugee camp and me out, you know, shooting this as a video journalist, shooting this accident, I'm editing in the back of my truck and I'm sending it back to I'm sending it back to my studio. And if I'm lucky, I'll go home to a husband and tell him how my day was, and that'll do the trick. But, you know, in the case of my husband, who thinks all journalists are scum and and please don't tell me about your war stories, you know, that's fair enough, right? You can't expect everybody to like this lifestyle. That's not going to happen. So in Bronwyn's case, she could actually, as the person who's the producer, she could build in and say, this is how we're going to do it. I'm in charge here. We're going to sit and debrief. So Bronwyn could actually sit and debrief with her team. Mm-hmm. And you could actually learn to actively hear people. Mm-hmm. So let's say somebody says, you know, that smell of gas when the tank exploded is just totally, totally making me feel raw and I don't know why. Mm-hmm. You don't go, oh, you stupid. It's about actually hearing the person say, mm-hmm. so that's mm-hmm. making you feel really raw.
But is it, sorry, so if I think, come in there.
Oh, jump in, because I've got something more to say, but jump in there.
No, I was just going to say, how realistic is that? Because obviously as a producer, I would mm-hmm. definitely, work in the same way that I would hire somebody to protect our physical safety, we would try and put that into place. Mm. But the reality, again, is while you're in the country, it's very mm-hmm. often not practical. And when you go home, everybody's off on different projects. Mm-hmm. I work as a freelancer and I work with different teams all the time. Mm-hmm. As it happens, one of the camera person on this shoot in Syria that I've been referring to is the same person who once was, who a couple of years previously, not more than two, was in a tunnel, a huge tunnel in Switzerland, mm-hmm. the Gotthard Tunnel, mm-hmm. and where directly in front of her and the sound man, they were chatting to the person who was participating in their film, and a train just came by and just crushed this person.
Oh, goodness.
Less than, you know, maybe, I don't know.
That's awful.
Really, really close to them. I mean, a person away from them. And so when you come back from a day's work, which is never, as you know, a day's work.
No, this it's 20 hours of work and then you've got to get up.
But maybe you're sitting down having some falafel to eat or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you start talking about things, what comes up? It's that sort of thing.
Yes, so you're actually doing it informally.
So you are doing it informally, but you're talking about, because that's the nature of humans. These were close friends with whom I was. Luckily, it was luck of the draw. But we still get on to, even if we're not, nobody's trying to prove anything, oh, this happened to me, that happened to me. But the thing is, you do talk about experiences, and inevitably you're not going to talk about the sunny day when you watch the sunrise. And you
So that's good. But the tone of voice is the question, I think, isn't it?
I'd just like to take a question.
Oh, yes.
From Karina Sturm.
Yeah, hi. Rachel, does it actually necessarily have to be a debriefing with a person? Like, for example, couldn't it also work that you just write down what you've experienced?
That's
in
a very
diary,
good question.
For example?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good question. And I think you're quite right, Karina, that could be that. It could be that the debrief, as you say, the debrief could be over the falafel or the debrief could be in a diary, right? What people have found is that when you have trauma, it detaches from what we call, it detaches from the center of the brain. That directs speech. So trauma memory is buried in a way that you find it hard to verbalize. If you're with a falafel and you're talking about how you feel, that is good.
But what I mean
that
is that
good
other
sign.
Other previous trauma.
Yeah.
In the professional while doing our professional thingies, which is a lovely word, the other trauma comes up. So we won't just be talking about what's happened that day. We'll be talking about but what I'm saying is
if you're able, yes.
Don't we
Yes.
then make a pile of
no,
trauma that
it
we
depends.
Say,
if you're sitting I've been sitting in circles of macho drinkers who were like, oh, the thing that, you know, I saw more skulls than you and oh, do you remember? Right? So it depends how much empathy's there and how much do you remember the mum who's seeing and listening. It's I think it's about being heard in an empathetic way.
Rachel and Bronwyn, we just have another question.
Go on.
Yep. Do you want to?
Sorry, I didn't actually have one. excuse me. So practically speaking, Rachel, I wonder, you're talking about something that's quite a human reaction, you know, to get together with your friends or your family, your partner,
yes.
to discuss how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
There's, of course, the isolation for people, journalists who are out in the field. Mm-hmm. When they get back, it's advisable maybe that newsrooms invest in this, but mm-hmm. I suppose really how, in a day and age where they can't even afford to pay journalists, mm-hmm. is it realistic to think that therapists and they can have
I'm not talking them. About therapists, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm talking, debriefing for me is actually a habit. It's, let's take the camp example, because we've got the camp example. Mm-hmm. So we've had a long day in the camp. If I was the producer, and I know this is not realistic nowadays because we don't budget for this, and this is where I think we have to change things. I think in the evening we sit around the table and we talk about our feelings. But of course, we're not going to do that if we haven't been told why we need to do this, right? And so what I think is that, and yes, it could be over a glass of wine or it could be natural. But I do think that as journalists, if we train to understand how important it is to digest these things, I think we will make it part of our professional mm-hmm, job. Mm-hmm. You know, we have decided that we're going to do risk assessment forums before we go out to make sure that mm-hmm. we don't get killed physically, right? And that has changed the industry in the UK, not everywhere. As a Swiss person, I never filled in a risk assessment form in my life as a journalist, mm-hmm, never. Mm-hmm. I learned about it when I started teaching in a British university. But we changed our culture mm-hmm. and we took it seriously. And I think that emotional health is just as important. Mm-hmm. We are not just physical beings. We are emotional beings mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is that we stop saying we have to be detached. Mm-hmm. I do think that we stop being pretentious. And I think this generation, your generation, is far less pushed to be detached than mm-hmm. our generation was, I guess. So the younger the generation, the more it's mm-hmm. okay mm-hmm. to have emotions. Mm-hmm. But I do think that newsrooms have to invest in time. It's not about paying a therapist. It's about all of us who are journalists learn this skill mm-hmm. to actively listen and show empathy and to actively be mm-hmm. open.
But if mm-hmm. I'm not to Rachel, let people I feel just, that you're... To be devil's advocate
yeah.
as well.
Go on.
I still have this problem about how realistic it is. Mm-hmm. I understand the benefit of it completely, and it is mm-hmm. something that I think we do try and do. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I mean, you just don't have the time. You're mm-hmm. exhausted. You've spent a mm-hmm. whole day in the dust mm-hmm. with emotional things going on, mm-hmm. plus all the logistical and mm-hmm. everything else, the technical. At the end of the day, mm-hmm. you're exhausted. And maybe you will naturally talk mm-hmm. about that, but maybe you won't. And it also depends on the team you have. If there's tension in the team, which can happen, especially
yes.
in stressful situations,
yes.
because mm-hmm. this is also teamwork.
Because that can also add to that. That can add to the mm. trauma that mm-hmm. you're in a team that's in television, especially because you've got
that's it.
You've got
as a VJ,
three
you
people
work
having
on your
to
own.
Work together. Yeah,
we don't
exactly.
And we don't choose our mm-hmm. teams.
Yes.
In any case, at Swiss Television mm-hmm. with the type of work that we do, magazine programs, mm-hmm. documentaries, you don't choose mm-hmm. your team, and that's actually also something that I've had a problem with.
Mm-hmm. So it has to be a change of general mm-hmm. culture in the industry,
yeah.
doesn't
general
it?
Culture,
so that
we're
everybody
not
understands
as
what we're talking about,
Rachel,
and understands the issues involved.
If you could say one thing to journalists, if mm-hmm. you know it's probably a while off to get this change in the newsrooms, what's one thing a journalist mm-hmm. could do then to mm-hmm. keep their mental health in mm-hmm. check?
Change career.
I mean, obviously, I've got a whole lecture on how you mm-hmm. can do debriefing mm-hmm. exercises, but that's another day, right? I've got
yeah.
lots more to say, but. If I could say one thing, I would actually agree with what some other people have said today whilst we've been talking about this topic. I think there needs to be a change of culture in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to understand that this will impact us physically and emotionally and mm-hmm. in our mental health if we don't take it seriously.
Yeah.
So just the same way that we said we're going to stop getting killed as journalists because we didn't fill in a risk assessment form.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? The same way we said we're going to stop...
It in.
We're going to stop working unsafely.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to say we're going to stop damaging our mental health by being more healthy
mm-hmm.
in the way we deal with these issues. And yes, that means our employers might have to pay for a bit of time for this. When that time is, if it's the next morning or if it's right then, I do think that employers have to make space for whether it's, you know, writing a diary, as Karina said, or whether it's having a falafel, as you said, or whether it's in the morning before we go out the next day. You know, we have to take this as part of our culture, that we don't just brush it off. Mm-hmm. That's what I really think. Mm-hmm.
Rachel Bronwyn, thank you so much for this discussion.
Thank you. It's been really interesting. It's been lovely being here.
Lots to think about.
And thank you to our questioners. Mm-hmm. And you've been listening to the Vonnie and Johnny show. Let's say that again. You're listening to the Vonnie and Joe show.
Yay!
I could be Johnny if you want to be. Thank you very much, everybody.